Hello. In episode 39 of the podcast, I'm really pleased to be speaking to Alistair Jarvis, Chief Executive of Universities UK. We begin by looking back at Alistair's career journey, which started out with a sabbatical role at the University of Kent, before he moved into a number of different roles which catered for his taste in public policy and higher education. This included a stint as Director of Communications for the now defunct 1994 Group, and following that, a period at the University of Birmingham as Director of Communications and Marketing. A return to London beckoned, and Alistair joined Universities UK, initially in external relations, and then as Deputy Chief Executive before successfully applying for the top job after Nicola Dandridge left to head up the Office for Students. Alistair sought to take on a different approach at Universities UK, getting the organisation to adopt clear positions on major issues rather than going for lowest common denominator stances, on the basis that whilst not every member would agree with every policy adopted all of the time, most universities would be on board on most occasions. We talk about the structure of UUK, the strengths of UUK International, and the core aspects of Alistair's role, from trying to influence policy through engaging with politicians and policymakers, engaging with members, and all of the governance and regulatory aspects of running an organisation. Looking at the bigger picture of government's attitude to and attacks on the sector, Alistair notes that universities are seen as a big target, and observes that a large proportion of the population now has some connection with an HE institution. This means that universities are under scrutiny as never before, and we have to be able to explain ourselves as well as finding ways to share the positive impacts of higher education wherever we can. Finally, we discuss Alistair's new role, starting imminently as Pro Vice-Chancellor for Partnerships and Governance at the University of London, and note that he will be joining AHUA in the new position. I do hope you enjoy it. Right, welcome everyone to the latest edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff, and this time it's my enormous pleasure to introduce Alistair Jarvis, who is Chief Executive of Universities UK, well, for another few weeks anyway. Welcome, Alistair.
Thanks, Paul. Great to be with you.
Well, I'm really, really delighted to be talking to you, as I say, before you quit the role to move on to pastures new. But I'd be really interested to hear about how you ended up as Chief Executive at Universities UK, which is, you know, it's a distinctive role within our sector. But you came up through very much through a kind of communications and public relations route, didn't you? So how did you end up at Universities UK?
So yeah, Paul, thanks. So my interest in higher education, perhaps unsurprisingly, started when I was at university myself. So I did a degree in politics at the University of Kent. And while I was there, I got involved with the student union and ended up being an elected sabbatical officer running the student union for a year. And that kind of got me a taste of actually the sort of policy and politics of higher education as much. And I got kind of under the skin of how universities work, obviously from a certain perspective, from a student union perspective. But I sort of thought as I was coming out of that, well, I'm interested in, my degree was in politics, I'm interested in policy and politics, but I'm also really interested in education, the power of education, the positive force of education to change things. And so from, you know, a reasonably early age, I was kind of thought universities are great things. I then went into, straight out of university, I went into a public policy consultancy. So it was events, communications, public policy. And I started off in a sort of generalist role, but I ended up heading their education team.
Neil Stewart Associates,
it was, right. Yeah. So I ended up heading their education team. And we was, you know, this was back in 2005, 2006, that sort of time, and I was running a small policy communications team. I went then into campaign group, big campaign group called it was called Enterprise Insight, but it ran the Make Your Mark campaign, which is actually the second biggest participation campaign in the UK after Children in Need. And the thing that, it's not a very well known name, but some of its almost thing products are, and it ran a thing called Enterprise Week, which a lot of universities, of course, get involved with, and also Global Entrepreneurship Week, which was across 100 plus countries. And it did things like Make Your Mark with a Tenor, which was a Peter Jones, the entrepreneur competition. But it was all about engaging young people in entrepreneurial activities. It was backed by the CBI and the British Chambers of Commerce and people like that. Yeah. But it was a campaign. It was to encourage people to be more entrepreneurial, but also working with schools, universities, that sort of thing. And I did their political engagement, so work with lots of MPs, cross-party, government, and I also did their business engagement. So it was a kind of external relations engagement role, and I headed that sort of team there. But funny enough, although I kind of enjoyed that, I was already missing education. So I then saw a role for the 1994 group, which is the now defunct mission group, which was for the smaller research intensive. So at the time it was Exeter, St Andrews, Lancaster, Bath, Sussex. It was sort of smaller research intensives for a director of comms there. And that allowed me to draw on my kind of comms experience, but get me right into higher education a bit more centrally again. So I did that for a couple of years, really enjoyed that. Realised that actually what I really wanted to do was a senior comms role within a university rather than sector-wide. And got the opportunity to work at the University of Birmingham. And that was one of these interesting integrated teams, comms, marketing, political affairs, events, both positional and sort of student focus, internal comms. So it was the kind of full suite of comms marketing things. And I was at Birmingham for three years in that role, and as you'll remember, a time when Birmingham and Nottingham were coming increasingly close, and we were doing things together then. Wanted to move back to London, so I my wife and I wanted a family. I couldn't really do that when I was half the week in Birmingham and half a week in London. I sort of mixed between the two. My wife had a job in London, and so moved back to London. I say work-wise back to London. I actually never relocated. And we started first of our three bringing up children, and now got three kids. And so I joined Universities UK as Director of External Relations. Did that for a couple of years. Started to get involved in stuff outside the sort of external relations space. You naturally do. You get involved in clearly on the policy side and other things. But actually, I also got quite involved in the internal side of the UK. There was some modernisation needing doing. And I chaired a business improvement programme, which was about the operational services within the UK. Yeah. And with doing that and the kind of comms external relations, new role came up as deputy chief executive, which I went for as an internal candidate and got. And so I was Nicola Dandridge's deputy for about 2 years.
Right.
And quite honestly, just as I was thinking about what to do next, and I'm, you know, very happy to say that kind of publicly, I was I'd been at UK by then 4 years, three and a half years, and I was starting to think, actually, you know, this deputy chief executive position, it gives me some opportunities across the sector. What do I go and do? And then Nicola went off to the Office for Students, and opportunity went. I was her deputy. I kind of had a decent view of the organisation, had some ideas about what we could do in the future, went for the job and got it. And then 5 years later, I'm still chief executive, but moving on in 7 weeks' time.
Oh, fantastic. And it was, I mean, it was a turbulent time when you took over, because you were pitched right into the middle of a pension. Well, you know, the last but one round of the pensions dispute, weren't you?
Yeah. So so there'd been many years of sort of fixes and fudges done on USS pensions that had got through one valuation or another without major disputes. And before I joined the chief executive role, so before I was having any role in USS, there'd been quite a few discussions with the pensions regulator, with the trustee, with employers about the need for more significant change to the scheme, because the scheme was in financial difficulty. And again, before I joined, employers had been spending a couple of years working up sort of more radical reform proposals. And I sort of inherited the sort of results of the consultation, which had sort of employers saying they wanted more radical reform to a DC scheme. And so I had to sort of pick up and run with that in my first few months, which was not the easiest nor the most pleasant experience, but, you know, but part of the job. And, you know, pensions is maybe 2% of what the UK does. Yeah. But for my first year in the job, it probably was a third of what I did.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and it must have been a challenging time, but you came through it. And I think what is really interesting is that UK appears over the past few years under your leadership to have changed a bit in terms of its character, to be something that is, and this is a perception that I have at working in one member institution, to be clearer on those things where it is able to articulate you know, very distinctly the voice of the sector in a way that I think it struggled to in the past, right? And was trying to be all things to all people. And so, I mean, is that something that you consciously approached as chief executive?
Yeah, absolutely. So actually through the interview process, part of the pitch I had was to say that we need to have a stronger voice. We can't always go to the lowest common denominator sort of position. And in fact, the only way to do that is to agree that you won't always have complete consensus, but you'll go with a sort of significant majority, in fact. And I think the worst possible situation for UK is always watering down everything to keep everybody happy and therefore never having a strong voice in anything, because you just don't influence that. I mean, the yeah. core of my job at the core of UK is to influence policy. Two things basically we do. We influence policy and we tackle cross-sector challenges, you know, guidance, advice, yeah. good practice, presenting the sector globally, partnerships. It's that and it's influencing policy. And you can't influence any policy debates if you're always saying, but this, but that, but the other. Well, this person says that, but actually the other view is there. You need to have a view, and you need to articulate a view, and you need to have evidence to back it up and argue it. Yeah. And so part of my sort of interview pitch, and I was sort of fortunate that at the time I was taking over, we'd just had a new president come in. Janet Beer had just been elected as president. And her view and mine aligned kind of completely on this, is that we have to take stronger positions on things. And sometimes we'll even say and do things that not the whole membership agrees with. But I've kind of always lived with a kind of 80-20 rule that if 80% of the membership are happy, the other 20% will probably live with it on that issue, because they'll be in the 80% in most other issues. If there was ever a university that disagreed with us on everything, that would be a massive problem. We would have to do something to sort of recognize that. But, you know, look at you at Nottingham. I would imagine that most of the policy positions we take on things you support. But there will occasionally be ones where you don't. But you sort of think, well, do I want to have a sector voice that never has a say on anything because we're always trying to get a consensus? Or do I accept on a few we might not be completely aligned, but it allows them to have a stronger voice on most things?
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree. And I think that, that's really well put, Alistair. But I think that explicit decision to go down that route has made a world of difference in terms of being clearer on those things where there is a distinct sector view that you can articulate, and therefore being better placed to influence those policy decisions than just doing the on the one hand, on the other hand stuff.
Because just two recent examples, actually, which I think kind of so admissions issues. As you know, we've got our Fair Admissions Code, now sector owned, voluntary for universities to sign up. The vast majority of the sector believe that it is in the sector's interest, reputationally and indeed fairest for students, for us to not offer conditional, unconditional offers. There are a small number of universities that have over recent years continued to use them, and some of them probably sort of feel, for various reasons, they would still rather like to use them. But it was very clear for the sector's reputation and indeed for the interest of students, which we've always got to think about, that this was the right stance to take. And yeah, so we took a stance for the sector, and we asked people to come behind us. Another one like that, we've got the consultation out on funding reforms at the moment. Every university in the sector will have a slightly different take on it. But frankly, SNCs are not going to be something that is good for the majority of the sector. There's going to be lots of concerns about minimum entry requirements.
Yeah.
There's real concerns about inflationary pressures. And okay, there may be slightly different nuances across the sector, but it's much better for us to take a firm, kind of clear stance on that.
Absolutely, absolutely agree. One of the areas which I think you've done particularly well on in the past few years, and I'm sure you know you won't want to take all the credit from this because you've got a number of colleagues who've done extraordinarily well, is on the international side. And the international unit, it seems to me, has really come into its own in the past few years under Vivian Stern. And I mean, has that been a kind of focus for you to support that area of activity?
Yeah, so I mean, to start with, to recognise absolutely Vivian's brilliant work and leadership on that, and she's a force of nature and has huge amounts of energy and enthusiasm for it, and is brilliant at that sort of external partnership building, and so she's really risen the profile of our international work has grown, our connections have grown, and the influence of that has grown. But yes, we have consciously invested in that area. I mean, it's what actually I think we've done. One part of it has been it's got a really clear strategy, a really clear focus. It's only got three or four priorities, which they sort of focus on, you know, very strongly. So actually, although we're doing more, we're probably, if anything, have f- focus on fewer, put more resources into fewer priorities rather than spread too thinly. And part of the way we've been able to do that is we've joined up things across the UK better. So a lot of international policy doesn't actually sit within UK International, it sits within our policy team. But the connections between our policy team and our international engagement sort of arm are now absolutely interlinked. The same between our communications campaigns team, how that links in now with UUKI, and actually just our how we engage with our members. We're trying to, so you know, we're an organisation of, we're seven organisations in the UK. We've got an interesting structure. So we're a group structure. And it's seven different entities. And about 15 million turnover, about 150 people across the seven. But there's University of Scotland, University of Wales. There's we've got a couple of revenue generating sort of units. So we are a building that's that generates income. We run a conference centre as well. We have UUKI, actually Medical Schools Council is also as part of the sort of family. But we've got these different organisations and they all sort of interlink. And one of the kind of challenges has been, how do we get the most out of that whole, and how do we sort of link them together? And so part of what I think has improved in our international work, certainly the team have done brilliantly, but we've got a bit more focus and we've got value out of our wider sort of relationships. So it's all kind of more interlinked, because so much of things are not domestic or international, they're interlinked. You can't.
Yeah. You know. But that's really interesting about that group structure. And lots of people simply won't appreciate that. But also lots of people will think that you're a much bigger organization than 150 people as well. Right. You know, given the scale of the, you know, the activity and span of work that you do. So 150 actually sounds quite modest.
And that is across the seven. That's across the seven entities. So obviously the core is only about 2/3 of that sort of the core, and then there's about a third in the sort of different entities. So the I mean it's interesting because I've had a couple of informal conversations with people that are applying for my job, and so they ring me up, and one of the things that they naturally say is so you know, what do you do? What do you actually do? And I basically do three things. Now each of those three things have lots of elements to them, but three things. One is trying to influence policy. So that's relationships with policy makers, you know, MPs, civil servants, also talking to our team about the policy development. So it's sort of policy political engagement. And actually I'd throw into that bit of the role, the media engagement you do, the partnerships with different organizations. It's all about influencing, really, sort of policy development influencing. Second part is member engagement. And I probably spend more time on member engagement than anything else. So regularly talking to vice chancellors, their senior teams, governing bodies. And in fact, I can't do my job unless, if a minister rings me up or a senior civil servant says, what does the sector think about that? I can't say, well, give me 3 weeks, I need to go and talk to the sector. I need to have something to say. Not necessarily debt, but, and the only way you can do that is to very, very regularly. So I do lots and lots of member engagement, visits, phone calls, group calls, you know, small round tables, dinners, all that sort of thing. So member engagement. And then the third bit is running an organisation, which has got quite a lot of complexity. And that's the bit everyone forgets. And when I talk to people, they'll go, oh, yeah, because actually, you know, as a chief executive, you've got legal responsibilities, you've got staffing responsibilities. But you know this very well as a registrar. You've got the governance. You know, we're a charity and we're a business. So we've got Companies House. We've got a charity commission. We've got a board of 21 vice chancellors. We've got five subcommittees of the board. So if you put governance, legal, staffing, budgets, yeah, that's one of the three big things I do, actually, is that part of the role. But that's the bit that's hidden. No one sees that. So they're the three things you do, really.
It's a bit that no one ever thanks you for either, you know, as well.
But if it goes wrong, it's worse than the other two. You know, I can get away with a few months without influencing anything, and I can get away with a few months with our members maybe not being quite so engaged. But if you screw up the finances or the governance or the legal side, it's an absolute, you know.
Absolutely right. But so, you'll never get any thanks for it. On the kind of policy influence, I mean, you know, the conversations with ministers, etc. I mean, the past couple of years have been, you know, a bizarre time for universities in all sorts of ways, right? But part of it has been this, you know, this bizarre duality, whereas on the one hand, we've actually been spearheading and supporting the national effort in relation to COVID, both in terms of, you know, vaccinations and in terms of students and staff helping out, you know, in all aspects of recovery and the health services, et cetera, et cetera. And on the other hand, we've been getting a right kicking from government in all sorts of ways, from everything from, you know, from, you know, free speech to, well, more free speech. But, you know, there's been so many ways in which, you know, universities are now just the first target for, you know, parts of the media, but also for MPs as well, whether they're unhappy about, you know, China or sexual harassment or anti-Semitism or whatever it might be. So how does that feel, look from a Universities UK perspective?
So I suppose in a kind of broad sense, I'd say the thing that sort of almost defines this government is it sees itself as a populist government. So, you know, politics and what they think is sort of public opinion sort of really matters. And they've taken a conscious decision that attacking institutions effectively is politically advantageous. And if you look at the National Trust, if you look at the BBC, if you look at global aid charities, if you look at, maybe slightly further back, kind of local councils, the police, you know, these are all legitimate targets for government in terms of putting pressure on them, calling them out when they're not happy with them. And universities are certainly in that category. So we are seen as part of the sort of establishment, liberal elite sort of, which they feel there is political benefit in challenging. So that, I think, one thing. I think the second is that there are times when the sector hasn't done itself favours. There are, you know, individual circumstances of either clumsy or bad practice or a bad process or a poor decision that has come into the public consciousness. Remember, with an era of 50% participation, universities are big news. And whether we do nothing interesting or controversial, or we do things that are interesting and controversial, we are legitimate sort of public interest, because a large portion of the population has an experience of universities. You know, they either live near one, or they see the economic impact of one, or someone they know works for one, or they've been to university, they've done a degree, or their child is, or they want their children to. Or so the UK's experience of universities now it's a majority experience. It's almost a majority experience for actually going through university. But if you look at touching universities in some ways, the employment, you know, the huge employers that universities are, and therefore we're fair game for the media. And then I think the third bit, and I think the thing that is really, really challenging, is we are under scrutiny from ministers, from the OFS, and from the media, sort of like never before. And universities, you know, need to ensure their processes, their practices, their decisions on things like course content, senior staff pay, equality and diversity issues. If these things aren't in a way that you can justify and explain publicly, you're really vulnerable, because we are under an era of great scrutiny. With ministers, some of this, I think, stems from a frustration. They don't actually have a lot of direct power over universities. So they have influence, certainly. But both enshrined in legislation, but particularly through the fact that we have raised a lot of our funding through fees, domestic, international, means that you don't have the levers, political levers, to pull like you do for local government or police or FE or schools or the NHS. You know, if the government wants to change any of those things, they kind of call the shots because they hold the purse strings. For universities, it's more subtle, as you well know, than that. Yeah. And I think that leads to a lot of political frustration. And I think it often leads to ministers using public pressure, the media, to put pressure on universities.
Yeah.
Often in areas where they don't actually have the power to do it. So I think that's part of it.
Yeah.
But you know, we have to also look at ourselves and say that we're not perfect, and there are times we can change. And sometimes we get, you know, frankly, universities get called out, and you think, yeah, we probably need to improve there or do better.
Yeah, no, I don't agree. And, you know, most universities are big and complex organisations with lots of competing interests in them, which are often completely irreconcilable at the best of times.
And things go wrong.
Yeah. Absolutely right. And, you know, unhappy people, it's much easier for an unhappy individual to make their view known publicly in a way, you know, than it ever used to be, because of, you know, the way that the media and indeed social media operate. So things can become very big, very public, very quickly, and you're left with a problem. I suppose one of the questions for me is the stance universities individually and arguably collectively as well should take, in that, given the, you know, the reality of the situation we're in, which I think you articulate it very clearly. So should our response be to say, yeah, well, fair cop, Gov, you know, we know we're not perfect, but we're all right, really? Or should it mean to be a bit more bullish about, you know, the great things that we do do and, you know, get your tanks off our lawn kind of thing? So, you know, which way should we actually go on this?
Both. So, so I think we have to recognize when there are genuine concerns that are so if there is a political concern over something, it is often driven by something. You know, it's driven, it may only be driven by anecdote, but often it is driven by public opinion. It is driven by some sort of evidence of some kind of problem, or at least perception of a problem. I think a perception of a problem is in itself a problem because, you know, if you have it, powerful people who effectively are, you know, who are elected, they do have some mandate and they do have some right to ask difficult questions and to raise issues. Therefore, if there is a perceived political issue, and particularly if it's one where there is public interest and it's in the media and things like that, I think universities do need to accept that if there are concerns being raised, they need to understand them and address them. That doesn't mean they need to accept what government's saying. They could explain to government why either that's you know, isn't the case, or they could suggest an alternative to the intervention the government's proposing. And an awful lot of times we sort of say, we have a challenge of what you're trying to achieve. But so you need to clarify, explain it, and maybe it would be better if you tried to look at something over here. But ultimately, if that's where you want to get to, here are some alternative ways of getting there that isn't necessarily the intervention that we think is damaging or difficult. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we should simply sort of say, well, our job is to sort of fight government on things. I think we need to try and understand why they have these views, and where we can try and sort of find a way that is, you know, is constructive. But I don't think that means we should stop saying what huge positive impact we have to communities, to society, to individuals, to the economy. Now, of course, from a government point of view, it's the economic impact which they most prioritise for universities. We've got a government that's focused, they see universities primarily as economic entities for skills, for jobs, for innovation, for business growth, particularly jobs and skills, actually. We've got a government that, but the public, I think we can reach out to far more broadly than that. We can show, you know, the benefit to individuals, to communities, you know, the fact that we train doctors, nurses, teachers, the fact that so many jobs in local communities depend on universities, the fact that we're wonderful cultural hubs, and, you know, all of these sort of things. I think we need to keep getting that message out to the public as well.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think you're right there, Alistair. I don't think we're on the whole terribly good at it because, you know, it, you know, we're, as institutions, we tend to be slightly self-effacing and, you know, a little bit modest and shy and retiring in relation to these things. But I think we do need to be a lot more upfront about the contributions that we do make. Yes, willing to accept when we've made mistakes, but yeah, absolutely telling people the great things that we do. And I know, you know, Universities UK has sought to bring that together as well through Made at Uni, etc. And that's fantastic. But I just think we need to do more of this stuff. I agree.
I agree. And you know, I recognise that Made at Uni is only sort of, well, one intervention over a number of years and sort of multiple strands. And we hope we're helping with that to sort of coordinate that and to give a voice. And I mean, what Made at Uni has been trying to do is to show the everyday impact of universities. So on individuals, on communities. So it's linking the brilliant things that universities do that are not very well understood to the public and making them more accessible, actually. And say, you know, did you know that there's things that are improving your everyday life that are because of universities, the universities are driving. But individual universities need to do that too. I mean, we did a load of research for almost 5 years ago now, and actually we may well repeat it in the year ahead, looking at sort of public opinion of universities, which helped to shape the messages for the Made at Uni campaign. And you may be aware, but what it showed was that broadly speaking, there wasn't a huge amount of hostility to universities in the public, actually. There was a decent group that thought universities were great. There was a big sort of group in the middle that were sort of thought, well, they're probably OK, but we just don't know very much about them. And then there was a sort of smaller kind of, well, we don't think they're very good. But the big middle group, what a lot of them said was, we could be advocates if we knew more. And that's why Made at Uni was actually about informing the public of what universities are doing. It wasn't sort of too overly selling it. It was actually trying to build understanding of what we do and also particularly understanding of how it links to everyday lives. And the thing that always jumps out to me from that research is people were more, could say things about why universities are good as a sector. they're trying to cure cancer. They train doctors. They're helping fight against climate change. That sort of thing, you'd get quite a large percentage of the population would say. But when you said, what does your local university do for you? A smaller percentage can answer. So strangely, it almost flipped on the head the perception the problem is we've got a sector-wide reputation. Yeah. And actually said that people are not getting those individual examples of how it's locally affecting them in their everyday lives. They kind of conceptually think of universities as kind of probably quite a good thing. You know, they're probably good for the reputation of the UK. They're probably good for the economy. They're probably good for health. But they couldn't give you examples of how their local university helped them. And I thought that was really interesting.
No, I think that is really interesting. And of course, they're also, if they're a local resident, likely to have quite possibly a negative view of the impact of students on their neighbourhoods, which, you know, can be challenging in many parts of the country.
Absolutely. Or yeah, certainly that perception, or in some universities, they'll sort of see the you know, almost as a sort of gated community, which, yeah. You know, that they are co-located with the university, but they're not really in the same community. I think that's another challenge at times.
Yeah. And but just, yeah, never seeing a positive. So, Alistair, you're moving on from Universities UK to jump back into the sector or an individual institution in the sector. University of London, it's a distinctive kind of university, big but unusual in the sector. So what role are you going to do there?
So it's a pro vice chancellor role. So it's one of, there's five people on the senior team, sort of four PVCs and the VC. It's one of those, and it's responsibility for partnerships and governance. And I suppose what it is it's as you know, no two universities are ever the same. There's never two same structures. But I suppose the kind of way to describe it is, if you think of a PVC external role, so sort of PVC external engagement partnerships, yeah. And you think of a traditional university secretary in a administration where you have a CEO and a university secretary, sort of separate things, it's the university secretary merged in with a PVC external. And so broadly speaking, it's sort of three areas. There's the external relations. So there's a great director of comms and marketing, great director of development, they'll report in, but they'll run those bits. And then there's the legislative, legal, governance, that side of things. And there'll be a sort of, you know, department there sort of running that. So that's everything from regulatory compliance, legal, working with governing body.
Which will be really interesting at the University of London because of the scale and complexity of the organisation.
Absolutely. And then there's the sort of unknown bit, which, as with any job you take on, you're never quite sure what you're doing until you get there. And I don't know if I've ever taken on a job where I've actually known before and more than about 10% of what I'm really taking on. But the other bit is strategic partnerships, I suppose. And that is really quite a sort of, in a positive way, a blank page in terms of some really interesting possibilities across the Federation. So you've got the central bits of the University of London, sort of primarily based at Senate House. You've got the huge T&E programme, 50,000 T&E students across the world. But then you've also got these 17 wonderful high-quality institutions in London who are part of the sort of federation. So the partnerships is both the partnerships externally. So who should we work with externally? What should be our big, important strategic partnerships to take the university forward? But also what should be the partnerships amongst federation as well? And that's the, so the other bits are kind of more fixed, the, you know, the governance, the regulatory side, the external relations, fundraising, that. But then there's this whole sort of wider question of, well, what does partnerships mean in a federation, for a federation, amongst federation nationally, globally. So
fantastic. Well, I'm sure you'll have enormous fun finding out how all these things work. But we need to stop there, Alistair.
And I will be an AHUA member, of course, as well.
Well, so indeed, I was going to say, I look forward to seeing you at future AHUA events as a fellow secretary, registrar, etc. So that's fantastic. But listen, thanks ever so much for your time, and you know, greatly appreciated it as ever. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and wish you all the very best in the new role.
A pleasure. It's been really good fun. Thanks, Paul. Maybe come back in a few years, and I can tell you what the University of London's like. Thanks.
Will do. Thanks ever so much.
Thanks, Paul.
That's all then from this episode of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. There will be another one along before you know it. And in the meantime, if you can't get enough of this kind of thing, there is an extensive back catalogue of previous conversations with University Registrars talking about lots of different stuff. Until the next time then.